1 Peter 5, 1-14, the 11th talk in a series on 1 Peter, was presented by Ron Julian on September 13, 2009, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, good morning. We're going to end our look at the book of 1 Peter this morning. So we're in chapter 5. Peter starts out talking to the elders, so I want to clarify a few things about the concept of elders so we have some idea of what he's getting at here. Over the history of the church, there have been many, many different versions of church organization. The word elder, for example, translates the Greek word presbyteros, from which we get our words presbytery and presbyterians. So there's an example for you of a particular view of how the Bible would tell us to organize church structure. The Presbyterians gave themselves the name that they did, partly because they defined themselves by the way they have organized themselves. They have ruling elders who are in turn under other ruling elders who are in turn under other ruling elders. And I think, in my experience, would argue that their structure is more or less dictated to them by the Bible. Other groups have a much looser organization. I probably don't have to point out that we fall into the looser organization category. So let me just say the idea of the elders, as I understand it, is the concept is a fairly simple one. I think it makes sense. It really starts in the life of the Jewish synagogue. I mean, they had elders, and really, in a way, they're just carrying over the same concept. As I say, I think it's fairly simple. You have a group of people, a religious congregation, who are gathered together because they believe roughly the same things, and they want to practice their religion and encourage each other in that practice. And in that community, there is part of the life there that is an individual one, each individual responsible for his or her own life. There are families, and they have responsibilities for their family life. But there is a congregational life as well. There is this coming together. What are we going to come together for? What are we going to talk about when we get together, and so forth? Who is it that's going to help guide the life of that community? Who's going to make sure that what's being said is what ought to be being said to the group, and so on? Well, it only makes sense that you would have people in that position who have been around the block a few times, or more than a few times. Not necessarily because older people are wiser than younger people all the time. I mean, I think it kind of goes back and forth, and I'm not sure I would even want to keep score necessarily. But the idea is that you do want to have somebody who's lived long enough with the particular commitment and set of beliefs that we're talking about so that they have an understanding of what it is that the group is about. You want someone who's gone through the fire a little bit, who knows what it is that the group stands for. Well, that makes a lot of sense in the New Testament context. It makes a lot of sense that the apostles would have continued that kind of practice. Paul gives a really specific description of what he's looking for in what he calls elders or overseers. And it basically boils down in what he describes is we're talking about someone whose life has shown that they're committed to the faith and have some experience living it out. I mean, that makes sense given the picture of the faith that we see in the New Testament. The idea that God is going to take us through trials and testing, things that are ultimately going to force us to come to terms with the faith and ask, is it for me? Is this what I want my life to be about? And as I understand the picture that we find in the New Testament, the idea of the elders is that you have some people who have been through that process and whose life shows something of having come to that decision that, yes, I know what the faith is. I've had the opportunity to sort out my life as to whether this is what I want it to be about, and I have made that decision for it. So, as I understand it, that's what the New Testament is talking about when it talks about elders. It's talking about people who have taken on a responsibility not for the individual lives of the people in the church. Each of us is responsible to God for ourselves, but for the life of the community. And you want people to be doing that who have shown some practical understanding of the faith in having had to live it out and decide for it. And then the task of the elder is basically to encourage, and that can include teaching or not necessarily, to encourage a particular group of believers to faithfully persevere as disciples of Christ. So I think it can take a lot of forms. It can be fairly loosely organized. It can be highly structured. But it's not the structure that is the issue, I don't think. The issue is, has a group of believers, people who are looking out for the life of the community, who have some have demonstrated some personal understanding and commitment to the faith. I think we've all had the experience, we've probably recognized that in the life of the church over the years, certainly in America, with the experience we have with the way businesses run and that sort of thing, that it has happened that churches have kind of fallen into the model of having people be in that leadership role who are there because they have business experience, say. Or, you know, we're thinking about it more in terms of the board of a company or the CEO or that kind of thing. And it is true that what we're looking for ultimately in the people who are going to be in that position of leadership is not so much business experience as faith experience. People who have had the opportunity to sort out their lives enough that they can stand up and say, yes, this is what I'm about, this is what we ought to be about. Okay. Now, we can understand why Peter would turn and say something to the elders at this point. If the picture that we've gotten in the letter is that the people he's writing to are having a tough time, they're facing the problem of, in the environment in which they're living, they're facing a great deal of hostility from unbelievers, and they're also having to sort out how to live amongst themselves. How are we going to respond to each other? Well, the elders are the ones who are called to encourage that group of people to stay faithful, to live out the implications of their faith. And one way to think about it is the elders are the ones who are going to, after Peter has written his letter, they're the ones who are going to have to take to heart what it is he's said and encourage the group in the very same sort of things that Peter has been trying to encourage them in. So it makes sense that he would speak to them at this point. But I think it's important for us all here to recognize that his focus is going to be not on things that are just relevant to the elder. That is, this is not talking shop. Peter the apostle, okay, let me pull you leaders aside here and let's talk strategy about how we're going to pull this off or anything like that. The elders aren't any different than anybody else in the congregation. They are sinners. They are human beings who are having to struggle and sort out how are they going to live their lives. And there are great temptations that come your way when you are in a position of leadership. So it seems to me that Peter's focus here is really going to be a word of personal encouragement to the elders to live out the implications of their faith as they are in this position of trying to encourage others to live out the implication of theirs. So what he's saying here is, for the sake of the church community, that the elders would be beneficial to their community, but I think even more it's for the personal benefit of the elders themselves. And as we'll see, what he has to say to them is actually relevant in one way or another, I think, to all of us. So you don't have to be an elder to profit from what it is that he's about to say here. So we're in chapter 5. I noticed we no longer have a clock back there. So, okay. Maybe I should pull that. Yeah, it's a sign. You guys didn't have anything you needed to do today, right? So we're in chapter 5, starting verse 1. Therefore, I encourage the elders among you, as a fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God among you, looking after it not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you, and not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, nor as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd comes, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. Okay, so Peter starts out here making a very personal appeal to the elders. He basically, on what basis is he asking them to listen to him? Why should they heed what it is that he's about to say? And he says three things. First of all, he is an elder like them. He is in a position of being a person who has lived out the faith, has been faithful in that process, and is responsible for encouraging a large group of Christians to pursue that faith. That's why he's writing this letter. So I think he's trying to say, look, there's this commonality between you and me. I've been in the position that you are in. I understand something of the challenges of having that kind of responsibility. And then secondly, he talks about his unique status as a witness to what Christ said and did. I mean, that's one of the fundamental roles of the apostles, is they saw Christ. They heard him. They heard his teaching. They saw how people responded to him. There's all sorts of things that Peter can testify to. It's interesting, though, that what he concentrates on here is that he was a witness to Christ's sufferings. And I think that fits right into the context. If you'll remember from last time, he was talking about how we share the sufferings of Christ. And in particular, I think the sufferings of Christ as in, to the extent that the world around us is hostile to what Christ is about, it will be hostile to us as well. So that's been his theme, is that Christ suffered, and if you're going to follow him, you may very likely suffer in the same way. So Peter's saying here, I was a witness to all of that. I saw how he lived his life. I saw the way people responded to him. I saw how it ultimately led to his death. So again, I know something about the sufferings that you're experiencing because I saw how the world responded to Christ himself. And then, thirdly, Peter reminds them that he shares their destiny. Just as he's been reminding them, he's been saying kind of over and over through the letter, talking about this hope that is coming our way on that glorious day when Christ returns. There is this wonderful thing that is coming our way that we're putting our hope in. So he's reminding them here that that's his hope as well. I mean, he is living on that same basis, facing struggles and suffering, but with this eager anticipation that Christ is going to come and fulfill his promises. So again, I think there's this element of, I'm in this with you. I understand what it's like here. I know that things are hard, but what I'm encouraging you to believe and find hope in is what I believe and find hope in. This is what keeps me going as I'm doing this stuff. So I think Peter's trying to make a very personal connection between himself and the elders to whom he's writing. He faces the same struggles and shares the same hopes that they do. So he's saying, Listen to my words of encouragement here, because I'm in this with you. And as we're going to see, and as I mentioned, what he's about to say here is not so much about here's the best strategy in running a church or something like that. He's really going to talk to them about the pitfalls, about the traps that they could easily fall into personally, spiritually. And that's the theme that we're going to explore here. It's interesting that Peter pictures their job as shepherding a flock. You may remember that Peter denied Christ three times. After the resurrection, we know that Jesus appeared to Peter personally. But then after that time in Galilee, Jesus appears to the disciples there. Peter and others are fishing. Jesus comes to them, and Jesus asks Peter three times, "Do you love me?" And Peter responds three times, "Yes, you know I love you." And then each time, Jesus responds to him with something like, "Shepherd my sheep," or "Feed my lambs," that kind of language. So, you love me, then I want you to love and take care of my people, I think is what Jesus was saying. And he uses the imagery of a shepherd and a flock. So it's interesting that Peter's using that same language now here to the elders that he's writing to. A shepherd was one who gave his life to the care of the flock, in fact, to the point of being willing to sacrifice his life to protect them. And that's really the picture that Peter wants to paint here, is a self-sacrificial concern for the people in the congregation. Okay, so problem is, and I mean, I don't feel like I have to tell you this. If you've been paying any attention throughout your life at all, and any organizations you've been involved with, including churches, and you just look on the news, I mean, it's everywhere. We recognize that being in a position of leadership represents a spiritual temptation of the first order, that being in that spot can very easily end up backfiring on us. Because we all tend to, as sinners, get our eyes focused on what's in it for me right now. What can I get out of this situation? I'm a needy person. I want a certain sense of security and importance in my life, and I have these various ideas for how I can take care of myself. And when that comes into contact with being in that position of being a leader, all kinds of ugly things can emerge. Okay, so his first warning is, shepherd the flock not under compulsion, but willingly. At first, I wasn't quite sure what he was saying there. I mean, is he saying, don't let anybody twist your arm and force you to be an elder or something? That doesn't quite seem to be, I mean, if you don't want to be an elder, I would think that his argument will be, well, you probably shouldn't do it. But I don't think that's quite what he's getting at here when he says under compulsion. I think the idea is that sometimes a responsibility can feel like a burden. Circumstances have brought me to the place where now I have this responsibility, but I don't really want to, and I'm constantly complaining, at least to myself and probably to other people, I don't want to be doing this, these people are a pain, and oh, you know, nobody ever helps out with this stuff, I'm always the person who has to do it all, and that kind of thing. I mean, it's so easy to fall into that. I recognize this in myself. I mean, Robbie can tell you that I used to say to her when we first knew each other that the last thing in the world that I would ever do was, like, be a pastor or anything like that. When I first started teaching, even, it's hard to describe, but I was just not about people. I was basically, okay, well, you know, I have some ideas that might be good to get out there, so, you know, I'll do this job. So I kind of came into the back door into the stuff that I'm doing now. I do a lot of teaching. You all know this. I teach here, and I teach at Gutenberg and at McKenzie Study Center. And we even homeschooled our kids, so I can hardly get a chance to not open my mouth. I'm just talking all the time. But coming into it through the back door, personally for me, I had something else I wanted to do in ending up here. It's easy. It would be easy, and I have at times, not now, but at times in my life, I think, sort of felt like I have fallen into something that wasn't really my first choice and not necessarily what I wanted to do. And there's a real danger in that you can feel sorry for yourself and your focus is really on, you know, the cost to me in doing this instead of the opportunity that is there to actually serve other people. So this is his first warning. It's similar. The word compulsion, Paul uses it when he talks about how our financial giving should be not grudgingly or under compulsion. And I think that grudgingly is the idea, just that sense of, oh man, this is a real pain, but I guess I have to do this. The problem is, I mean, everybody, we all complain about things. I'm not saying that you're going to feel ever be free of complaining. We're not good enough to avoid that, I don't think. But that fundamental sort of sense that I'm being put upon in doing this arises from having lost a vision for what the opportunity is, lost a vision for the fact that there is something really important and significant about being able to encourage each other in the faith, even if it costs us to do it. So that's his first warning. Take this on willingly. See it for the significant, important, valuable thing that it is. The second thing he warns them is to shepherd the flock not for sordid gain, but with eagerness. And again, we just don't have to even hardly take any time to explain how being in a position of leadership, even in the church, can end up being a route to sordid gain. I mean, all we have to do is look around. You get a group of people together who are committed to a certain thing, and you put yourself in the front so that you have the opportunity to dictate what goes on, and there is an opportunity to use people for financial gain. It doesn't have to be the church. We see it happening all over the place. We see organizations that started out being very much dedicated to, you know, helping in some situation or other and ends up becoming the little empire for somebody who's profiting off of it. But that's Peter's second warning, is don't fall into that trap. You're not in the position of leadership in the group so that you can profit off of it. Now, don't let me imply here that there's anything wrong with financially supporting those who are in a position of leadership in the church. Paul is quite insistent that there's something appropriate and right about that. There's something worthwhile about cheerfully taking on the opportunity to help those who are helping the church. So it's not that there is anything wrong with being supported in being in the position of leadership in a church. Paul also uses the language of the teaching elder he describes it as being worthy of a double honor, or it's basically, I think you could say, the meaning of the word, it's kind of like he should be paid double. I mean, if he's leading and teaching in the church, then there's something really valuable about that. So we ought to eagerly support those who are helping us in that way. And, you know, it's always funny to talk about this stuff because obviously I'm up here teaching. So, I mean, hey, sounds like I'm saying, you know, make sure that you send a little my way. That's not, I hope you understand, it's not the spirit at all of why I'm saying this stuff. I'm really talking to myself as much as to you. I mean, we all have this obligation to represent, to reflect with the way we use our resources what we value and what we think is important. So, you know, I face that same question. You know, is the promotion of the gospel, is the encouragement of believers something valuable to me that I would spend my resources on it? So I'm not against that at all. But Peter's talking to the elders here. He's talking to the people who are in that position of having to decide, how am I going to conduct myself? I'm in this position, And he's warning them against the temptation of using it basically as a way of satisfying their own greed. And then, thirdly, he warns the elders to shepherd the flock not as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. And this is just this is hugely important to me. I think this is so important. And it applies to all of us. It's not just elders. But there is a profound desire that runs through human beings. I don't know if it especially runs through men. It's possible that it especially runs through men. I'm not actually sure about that. But that desire for power, that desire to be in that position where my will is being imposed in one way or another. And being in leadership can be a great temptation. And being in leadership in the church can be a great temptation. We have the Bible's support. Someone who's in leadership in the church, the Bible talks about how important it is. I mean, Peter is suggesting that it's important. Paul talks a lot about how it's important. He talks about how it's important that we support that person financially. And Peter's going to talk here about submitting to the elders. And, you know, so the Bible tells you that you got to do what I say. I mean, right? I mean, I've got scriptural support for getting my way. So the temptation is huge. I mean, that's a misstatement, what I just said, but I mean, that's what it looks like. That's what it can seem like. So the temptation is that being in a position of leadership in the church, that we start to fall in love with being the person that everybody has to listen to. And I really divide in my mind over the years, the people in ministry that I have known, I divide in my mind. There are those that I look at who have not fallen into that trap, and there are those that I look at that have fallen into that trap. And it is a huge trap. I think it's quite possible for pastors to fall into this trap and not realize that they have done it. It's that desire to be the boss, to give myself that sense of I'm the one in control here. I get to get my way, and I get to have that sense that people need to submit to me. Peter gives exactly the right antidote to that problem here. He says the job of the elder is not to lord it over people, but the job of the elder is to be an example. In other words, is the elder joining Peter in calling us as believers to gracious self-sacrifice, to give of ourselves for the sake of hostile unbelievers, to treat them with respect so that the gospel might have a hearing with them, and to forgive each other and put up with each other, to be on each other's side as the people of God? Is that what the gospel is calling us to? Then that's what the elder ought to be about. Gracious self-sacrifice. Be an example. Don't lord it over, folks. Take the lower seat. Live out in your own life what you think everybody else ought to be living out. And he's not calling the elders to put on some sort of act. Let me live out this pious act and everybody join me. I think he's just saying very simply, look, basically your job as an elder is to live out a faithful life as a believer while you are exercising the responsibilities that you have in this group. That's your job. Not to be boss, not to lord it over folks, but to take on a life of trusting in God and giving yourself for other people. If you're doing that, then you're doing your job right. Peter concludes by saying that when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. And I think there's both encouragement and warning in this statement. It's a repetition again of this idea that there is this great glory coming when Christ returns. But there's also this warning to the elders that they are servants of the chief shepherd. That they have a boss. They are living out their own faith or lack of it in the way that they treat Christ's people. Their opportunity now is to live as believers while they are serving the church. If they want the chief shepherd to welcome them with an unfading crown, then they need to let their true belief in the gospel guide them as they teach and encourage the people. Now, let me just back up here then and say that this is relevant to all of us, I think, whether we are elders or not, because each of us has our own arena of life. Each of us has our areas of responsibility. We have the people we interact with. We have the people we serve. We have the people that we are responsible to, and so on. And we have this choice that we have to make about how we are going to treat other people in the midst of those responsibilities. And it seems to me that we all face these similar sorts of temptations in whatever arena we're working in. There is the temptation to take on the responsibilities that God has given us in life grudgingly, complaining, without that sense that there is dignity and purpose in my little offer of service and whatever it is that I'm doing. We can take on our responsibilities with an eye to the main chance, as they say. You know, how can I make some money off of this deal? How can I use the people around me to profit myself? And there's always that temptation, that quest for power, that desire to put myself in a situation where I'm going to be able to prevail somehow in this. So the advice that Peter's giving the elders, it seems to me, is something that hits home for all of us. And the issue for all of us is the same. It's not just, Peter isn't just saying, don't do that stuff because I don't like it and it's not nice. To fall into those things is to have lost sight of fundamentally what is the faith about. What's the point of being an elder, for example, whose job is to encourage a group of people to faithfully follow as disciples of Christ? What's the point of doing that and then doing it in such a way that you yourself have lost sight of what it means to be a faithful disciple of Christ? And that's a question that we all face. Okay, in verse 5, Peter says, "The younger ones, likewise, be subject to your elders, and all of you clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. For God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety upon him, because he cares for you." He speaks to the younger ones here. It's a little tricky. I assume he basically means those who are not the elders. I mean, we can imagine that he's just talking to the younger people in the group. So elders and responsibility, you at the other end who are young, leaving the folks in the middle to kind of fend for themselves. I don't think that's right. I think he's basically dividing it into there are those who are in that position of responsibility and those who aren't, I think is the way he's thinking about it. Although he may have in mind, we all are aware of that sort of time-honored little bit of competition between the old and the young, that he may be speaking to that a little bit here. I don't want to talk a lot about the concept of submission here. There's a lot we could say about it. I've talked some before. I just want to remind you that this submission that Peter is calling for here is a limited one. I think that Christian groups that have taken on the idea that the elders, the leadership in the church, are basically dictating to the rest of the people in the group how they ought to live and sometimes very specifically dictating that, I think that's a profound misunderstanding of the nature of the responsibility that elders have. We are called to submit to the extent that someone has responsibility for something. And the elders in a group of Christians have a very limited responsibility for the life of the church and what's being taught and that kind of stuff. But no one has the right to come along and say to you, this is how you ought to exercise your conscience in the midst of your life circumstances and so on. That's 'cause when you stand before God, you're not going to be able to say, he said. I mean, God's going to say, well, I don't care what he said, what did you do? And so if you're the one who's going to have to answer for it, then you had better make your own choice on that. So submission, as I say, is a limited kind of thing, but is a real thing in that we ultimately recognize, okay, so if I were running things, I might do things a little different here, and I'll speak up and say so, but ultimately I'm willing to acknowledge that's your responsibility, not mine, so I'll go along with that. That's the basic idea. The real point here, though, in this section, that Peter recognizes that the real danger on all sides for elders and non-elders is arrogance and pride, self-centeredness, basically. He's calling all of us to humility. Now, let's just be clear about what we mean by humility here. If you've painted a painting and somebody comes along and says, that's great, Peter doesn't mean you're supposed to say, oh, no, it's really not good. I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, that's kind of what we think of as humility, like self-deprecating. I think it would be entirely appropriate to say, well, thanks. Yeah, I'm kind of happy with how it came out myself. I mean, that's not a lack of humility in Peter's terms. We can see it in contrast. He uses the word pride, arrogance, but he also contrasts waiting for God to exalt us. The idea of lacking humility is to be self-promoting. I'm going to push myself forward, make sure that my desires and needs get taken care of first. To be humble toward each other is to recognize the importance of the other person's needs and desires and to wait ultimately for God to raise me up. I'm not going to push myself forward. I'm going to wait for God to take me to the place of exaltation. As we're trying to sort out how we treat each other, the fundamental issue that we face is who do we think is going to take care of us in the end? Are we in the hands of the creator of the universe who cares for us and can be trusted with our life? Or are we left on our own? Do we have to grab and snatch and claw to make sure that we get what we want and what we think that we need? And that's what Peter is getting at in these verses. If God is really there, if my faith is true, and he really is who he claims to be, then there's really only one solution to the problem of my life. One day, at the proper time, God is going to raise me up. He's going to say, well done, good and faithful servant. He's going to give me a place among his people. I will have an existence that is glorious and honorable and fulfilling. Everything that I would like out of life, everything that I would like to feel about myself, that I would like to feel about my relationship with the people around me, that I would like to feel about my security and my place with God, all of that is going to be established and strong. I'm going to be secure and happy in the life that I have, happy about myself. That's what God has promised. But I'm waiting, trusting God that he will in fact raise me up at the proper time. That's what we're called to. So I should trust God in this way because, as Peter says, he cares for me. The problem comes when we don't really see God as the one who cares for us, as the one who will exalt us at the proper time. It is easy to forget. It seems like I'm alone in this, that if I don't look out for myself, nobody else will. So if that's the case, then just in subtle ways, we are living our lives in competition with each other. There is this way that life is going to be fulfilling if only I can get you all to go along with me on this. So we recognize that sense that I have to be looking out for myself in all of this. Now, this may seem like a trivial thing, but I've been a human being a long time. I've watched us and the way we do things. And one of the things that always has been striking to me is that you notice when we get together and talk, just watch what happens. One person's talking about themselves, and you can just see how the other person is sort of waiting, like, okay, when are they going to be done so I can talk about myself? And you can just watch this conversation go back and forth. Oh, okay, here's my shot. It's saying something about me. But, oh no, I brought up a topic that reminds the other person of something that they wanted to talk about themselves, and now they've got it. And so the ball's kind of going back and forth. There's a little jockeying for position, you know. Well, it's kind of a silly thing, but it says something about what's going on inside of us, and we all do it, is that we're really focused on what can I get out of this, you know. That's a complicated question, but we really are focused on that. Well, that comes out when you get a group of people together and we're trying to work out how are we going to do this thing. The fact is that it can end up ugly. It can end up really ugly. I mean, how many... We all laugh about the story of the churches that ended up splitting over what color the rug in the narthex is going to be or something like that. But this not really that's not a straw man, and that's not really silly. It just arises out of that sense of the fact is that what color the rug in the narthex ends up says something about my importance in all of this. The fact that I lost this argument says that I don't have the place in this organization that I want to have. We're going to face this question. I probably shouldn't say this. Everybody's going to come and kick me for saying this. But the fact is, we're not going to be in this building forever. And that is going to be coming probably fairly soon, that we're going to be moving. And there has been this great effort by a number of people to work out where are we going to go and how is this going to work. And I can just guarantee you that when we come along and say, this is how we've worked it out, that we're going to have to do this because we can't stay here anymore, that some of you are not going to like it. I mean, I just know. I mean, we just know already, right? And how do we deal with that? I mean, how do we respond to, we can be personally affronted that our choice didn't get picked, or we can be personally affronted because we weren't in the group that decided, or I mean, all of that kind of stuff can happen. And I'm not pointing the finger at you, I'm pointing the finger at us, all of us. I mean, this is just how we tend to do things. So this is what Peter is getting at, where the rubber meets the road, having humility towards each other, not pushing myself forward, but stepping back, taking the role of the servant and being willing to recognize that I'm not always going to get my way and I'm not always going to like the way things go. But in the end, the one who's going to take care of me is God. I should turn to him because he cares for me. That's what Peter is getting at here, basically. Okay, well, I better move on from that. Let me just finish up quickly. Got started a little late here today. We're in verse 8. He says, this is his kind of final words of encouragement in his letter, "Be sober in spirit, keep awake. Your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Hold your ground against him, firm in faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. And the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, although you have suffered for a little while, will himself prepare, build up, strengthen, and establish you. His is the power forever and ever. Amen." Let me just quickly clarify two things here. He talks about suffering here, the same experience of suffering. I think at the focus of his attention is the suffering that he's been talking about at the hands of hostile unbelievers. But I don't think it's inappropriate for us to recognize that all of the spiritual challenges that we face involve suffering to a certain extent. Yes, the hostility of the world brings suffering, but we bring suffering on ourselves through our own sins and the challenge that we face living together, figuring out how we're going to deal with each other. There is suffering in that. So The suffering that he's talking about here, ultimately, I think we can see it in broad terms. My other clarification is at the end, where he talks about God will himself prepare, build up, strengthen, and establish you. We have to decide when we look at that, when is he talking about? Is he saying, if you persevere in faith now, someday God will set you up in heaven? I mean, is that basically the language that he's using here? I don't think so. And I think it's actually important to us to recognize what he's talking about here. Each of those four words, if you look at the way they're used in the New Testament, each of them is usually used in context that's talking about establishing us in the faith now. That is, in our weakness and foolishness, God is taking us through experiences and working in our hearts such that our faith becomes grounded and solid and stronger, and we are able to resist. We are able to faithfully live out the lives that we have been given precisely because the power of God is at work in us. That's a very common theme in the New Testament, the idea that ultimately, on the one hand, we are called to live faithfully, but on the other hand, the only reason that we can is that the power of God is ultimately at work, establishing, strengthening us, and so on. And I think that's what Peter is getting at here. So let me just describe then quickly the big picture in 8 through 11 there. For the third time in this letter, Peter has warned us to be sober and awake. It is so easy for us with our day-to-day concerns to be distracted from the truth of who God is, what he has promised, and how he's calling us to live. We just forget it. We lose sight. And the problem is even worse than you might think, because not only do we have our own sin and our own sort of drowsy short-sightedness to deal with, and that would be enough. Believe me, it would be enough just dealing with that. But we have an adversary. We have an enemy. Satan, the enemy of God, wants nothing more than to keep us drunk and distracted to our own eternal destruction. And I really do think the Bible is inviting us to look out at the world around us, at the state of the understanding of the people of the world. What kind of a place is it? How do people think, and what are they looking at? And to see, to a certain extent, a reflection of the God of this world. He's got us bamboozled. He's really succeeded in blinding our eyes. Human evil is a big problem, but it gets a little boost by the world system that Satan has promoted. This is why we need to fight to stay awake. This is why we must hold our ground firm in faith. But we need to remember that we are not left on our own in this fight. The God who gives grace, the God who called us to his glory, has not abandoned us, and he is in the very process of, in the middle of these trials and suffering, strengthening, encouraging, establishing us. So when we think about our responsibility to encourage each other, when we think about the elders encouraging us, when we think about us, each of us encouraging each other, ultimately who we're really counting on is God through his Spirit bringing these things home to us in a way that they really take hold. His is the power forever. There is no other power, Satan's or our own, that can prevail against him. Let me read you the conclusion of the letter. Verse 12, through Silvanus, our faithful brother, as I regard him, I have written to you briefly, encouraging and testifying that this is the true grace of God in which you should stand. She who is in Babylon, chosen together with you, sends you greetings, and so does my son Mark. Greet one another with a kiss of love. Peace be to you all who are in Christ. And I'll just comment that Silvanus is probably the man that we know by the name Silas in other places in the Bible, accompanied Paul on some of his missionary journeys. There's debate as to whether Silvanus is just carrying this letter or whether he actually helped Peter write it. Most people think that when Peter says Babylon here, he actually means that he is writing from Rome. And I just point out, notice his summation. It sums up his letter pretty well. He has written to encourage and testify to the true grace of God, which that is the message of the gospel, so that we might stand in it. Okay, the word that comes to my mind when I think of 1 Peter is the word perspective. Peter makes a number of moral exhortations: love each other, be gracious to unbelievers for their own sake, and so on. But I would argue that Peter is not primarily a moralist. He is not just saying, be nice. He's trying to give us perspective, to remind us of the big picture. Ultimately, our decisions about how we act arise out of our sense of the world, what we think is true. To the extent that we believe in one picture of the world, we're going to act as if that picture were true. To the extent that we believe in another picture of the world, then we're going to act as if that picture was true. And he's trying to tell us the picture out of which we ought to be living. Christ has come into the world to call together a people for himself and for the Father. He did so by bringing us mercy and forgiveness and working ultimately to restore us to true righteousness and life. He's coming again one day to complete and fulfill all the promises that God made to his people, which gives us great hope. Meanwhile, we are called to live as the people of God in the world, having a great hope, but being the people of God in the world now. That implies that we have three relationships that we have to deal with. As the people of God in the world, we have our relationship with God, we have our relationship with God's people, and we have our relationship to the world. And the gospel has implications for each of those things. If I believe the gospel, then it is going to have an effect on my relationship with God, on my relationship with you, and my relationship with the rest of the world around me. Peter, today, we saw, urges us to remember that God is the one who cares for us and will raise us up at the proper time. And that's really the foundation for everything he's saying here. Why can we self-sacrificially love the people of the world who hate us? Why can we self-sacrificially give ourselves for the sake of the other people of God in our lives? Well, ultimately, it's because that we believe God is there, that he's on our side, and we can count on him to come through for us. Okay, so I'm sorry I went late here this morning. Let's just take, if anybody has something that you would really like to ask about, let's just take a minute and do that. I mean, this is the end. I'm done. Next week it's somebody else. I don't know who. Some loser or other is going to come along and try.
Ron, you could address this online if you want, but in 3:16 he talks about being reviled for Christ, and in 4:14 he talks about being reviled for Christ.
Uh-huh.
What does that mean, and what do we have to do to get it? What do we do that we want to do that?
Right. Well, I see it very much as like... In the Beatitudes, Jesus used the language, blessed are you when people speak evil of you and slander your name, or I don't remember exactly the language that he uses, for my sake. And then he says, you're blessed to be in that situation. That's how they treated the prophets before you. The idea, I think, is that, not that this is always going to happen, I mean, this is just a general truth about the way things tend to go in the world, is that to the extent that I in my life come to represent, that people can see in me what Christ was about, to the extent that people don't like that, to the extent that people, if Jesus were here saying it, they wouldn't like it from him, they're not going to like it from us either. So reviled for the name of Christ means basically, it's the fact that I have identified with that name and the values and truths that Christ taught, and people look at that and say, no, that's bad. That's, you know, whatever it might be. That's fundamentalism. That's religious bigotry. That's naive superstition instead of science, or, you know, whatever it might be. I think that's what he's getting at. Does that answer your question?
Well, yeah, and it still leaves me a little confused, because if I invest myself in the moral character of Christ and try to emulate him, I just go about my life and I be faithful to my wife and kind to my neighbor and truthful in my voice and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I can't imagine anyone saying, I hate that guy. And why? Well, because he's faithful to his wife and he's kind to his neighbor and he's truthful in what he tells you. And it's like, that's not going to piss anybody off.
Well,
it sounds only when I say out loud, mm-hmm. when I make the mistake of saying out loud, and by the way, Jesus is Lord, mm-hmm. and we are all subject to him.
Right.
Just in case you ask.
Right. Well,
it's only when I go out and do things which will...
If we look at what Peter's been saying, we can see that there are different aspects to this. I mean, remember one of the things he said, they're astonished that you won't join them in their dissipation. So there are those situations where people, the fact that you're living a certain way, even without identifying it as with Christ, just people get uncomfortable by the fact that you won't affirm the choices that they've made in life by joining them in living that way. So that's one possibility for what can happen. So that can happen. But I think when he talks about the name of Christ, the assumption here is that, yeah, that you have identified yourself publicly with Christ, that people have come to know, oh yeah, you're one of those. And that it is in response to that people are upset. But now notice at the same time that Peter agrees with you when he talks about how to interact with the government and with your master and just in general how to interact with the world. He seems to hold out the hope that a genuine, humble concern for the other person might actually overcome that hostility. They might actually say, yeah, there's something about that guy that is kind of attractive to me. So yeah, it might happen that way, but it might not. I mean, it's easy to see. Well, maybe it isn't, but it seems to me, what I've seen, that it's easy for that to go wrong. There's just things about it. People are going to think, oh, you think you're right and everybody else is wrong. You think you're better than other people. And once people get on that track, every time you do something nice, they're just going to interpret it as being, you're one of those pious hypocrites or something, you know. I mean, that can easily happen. And sometimes we deserve it, but sometimes we don't. And then yet it happens anyway. So I think there's a whole variety of things that can happen as I would see it.
It makes sense when my mom tells me about when we lived in Texas, when I was a little kid, and she told my dad, Kurt, we're going to have to move or you're going to be bailing me out of jail. Because the civil rights movement had begun, and her best friend in high school happened to be African American, and she wasn't a racist. And we lived in Texas, mm-hmm. and then we moved to Mississippi, mm-hmm. you know, things, and then we moved back to Indiana, which, and I said, there I could see where my mom, in her faith, mm-hmm. would have been identified as a real Christian who was rocking the boat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there are plenty of opportunities for that kind of thing to happen in the world. What can be confusing to us, as I've said as we've gone along, is that Christians, religion is a ground that promotes self-righteousness. And Christianity is a soil that has promoted self-righteousness. And so there's a lot of stuff that goes under the name of Christianity that is, in fact, a particularly ugly kind of self-righteousness, and people see it, and they recognize it, and they don't respond to it, and then we get tarred with that brush. That's what Christianity is about. And that complicates the question, because that's absolutely true. But sooner or later, because we're all human beings made in the image of God whose minds are alive to the issues that we face, even though we try to thrust it back. Sooner or later, if someone is hiding from God, if they see a reflection, a genuine reflection of that in you, they're going to want to hide from you too. I mean, and I can't say how it's going to look, because I think it just looks a whole variety of ways differently. And we make it worse because we do stupid things. But maybe I should just stop there. We're kind of late. It's been good going through this with you. I've enjoyed going through 1 Peter. I've never really studied my way through the book before, so I feel like I've learned a lot. I hope you guys have learned something from it. And I is not a loser. It's a great person next week who I just don't happen to know who it is. But...